Hi.
So, first, I need a little Japanese lesson. Suzuki, what does this mean?
Well, Suzuki is, it depends on how you write it, but I translate it as bell tree or bell wood. Ki is tree or wood, and suzu is a bell.
Wait a second, my motorcycle that I thought was a hot rod is actually a bellwood?
I'm afraid that's how it translates, yes indeed.
You grew up in Canada as a Japanese Canadian, and in your book you describe your experiences during World War II when your family wound up in internment camps and how that affected your life work. Could you tell us that story?
So both my mother and father were born and raised in Canada, in Vancouver. They spoke English at home. I didn't speak any Japanese, and I thought of myself as a Canadian kid. And on December 7th, when Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, our world turned upside down. Then they imposed an act called the War Measures Act, which enables governments to suspend all rights of citizenship. And they shipped us off to camps for the duration of the war. So I grew up then in these camps surrounded by other Japanese kids. And ironically, I was beat up by the other Japanese kids because I couldn't speak Japanese. So my first experience of prejudice was from other Japanese kids. There wasn't any school for a year and a half because they didn't have enough teachers. We were interned in camps that were in the heart of the Rocky Mountains. So for a kid, it was glorious. I didn't want to hang out with these other kids. So I went off in the woods and I was fishing for fish, which we ate, of course. And I'd encounter bears and wolves and moose and nature in its rawest form. And for me, that was a critical bonding period for me and nature. It's just a part of who I am now.
And led you to science.
Led me to science ultimately. And first, a lot of it started from my interest in fish, because I used to fish. I thought, gee, maybe I'll become an ichthyologist, someone who studies fish. Then I got really keen on insects. And I thought, gosh, I could become an entomologist. I love beetles. And I collected them and displayed them and won a lot of prizes. But then when I got to college, I fell in love with genetics and ended up doing a study on the genetics of an insect, a fruit fly.
On the cover of your book, The Legacy, An Elder's Vision for Our Sustainable Future, you have a maple seed, you know, the little thing that becomes, it spins as it falls to the ground from the maple
right.
tree.
Yeah, to me, that seed symbolizes an opportunity for us to try to copy nature. You know, trees can't get up and drop their seeds all over the place like an animal might. And so they've got to rely on methods to get their seeds spread away. And one method, of course, is to use the wind and the air and take your seeds in and move them by this helicopter-like motion. One of our problems, I think, is that we try to overwhelm nature with the power of our crude technologies, and oftentimes it creates ecological problems. Nature's had 4 billion years to evolve basically solutions to the same things you and I have, you know. How do you keep from being eaten? What do you do when you get sick? Where do you find something to eat? What happens when you have to go to the bathroom and get rid of it? What do you do with that? How do you get laid? I mean, all these things, nature, every species has had to deal with these issues. And if we were to look to nature, we could learn a lot with a far less deleterious effects.
Earlier in your book, you mentioned that the population of the world has tripled in your lifetime. That's a pretty striking statistic.
It's staggering. We're in that terrible phase of exponential growth. We appeared as a species in Africa maybe 150,000 years ago. We wandered nomadically and gathered food and shelter. It was 10,000 years ago that the big change happened when we discovered agriculture. At the beginning of the agricultural revolution, it's estimated there were about 10 million of us on the entire planet. Agriculture heralded a huge shift because we could now grow our food dependably, and in only 8,000 years, we increased by another order of magnitude to 100 million people. And then in just over 1,800 years, we increased by another order of magnitude to 1 billion people early in the 1800s. And then in less than 200 years, we reached 6.9 billion people in 2010. So if you were to plot that on a piece of graph paper, the curve is essentially leaping straight off the page in the last pencil width of time. Nothing can go straight up off the page indefinitely. There's got to be limits, and I fear that we're going to have some major problems of a big human die-off.
So, yes, what is the problem of population? What are the consequences that you are concerned about?
Well, of course, it's not just a function of number. It's the amount of stuff that we exploit out of the biosphere per person. So if we in North America want to compare ourselves with China or India, you got to multiply our populations by at least 20 to get our impact, our equivalent impact as Chinese or Indians. If you want to compare us to Bangladesh or Somalia, you got to multiply by at least 60. And when you look at it that way, then it's clear that it's the industrialized world, because of our hyperconsumption, we are consuming over 80% of the planet's resources, even though we're only 20% of the world's population. We are the major predator on the planet. My great teacher, my inspiration, my mentor was my father. And in 1994, he was dying. He kept saying, "David, I die a rich man." He never had money at all. He was never a rich man. But he kept saying, "I die a rich man." He never once said, "Gee, David, you remember my closet full of all that stuff? You remember the fine clothes I had, or the big car I bought in 1987, the house I owned in London, Ontario?" All we talked about were family, friends, and neighbors, and the things that we did together. That was my father's wealth. Somehow we've got off in this idea that having money, having stuff, having bigger, newer stuff, this is what makes us happy. That's not what life is about at all. In his last month of life, my father showed me what is really our true riches, and that's people and what we do together.
Let's talk about the economy. In your book, you quote a couple of economists and retail analysts. One of them is Victor Lebo. You quote him as saying, "Our enormously productive economy demands that we make consumption our way of life, that we convert the buying and use of goods into rituals, that we seek our spiritual satisfactions, our ego satisfactions in consumption. The measure of social status, of social acceptance, of prestige is now to be found in our consumptive patterns." And he goes on to say that the greater the pressure upon the individual to conform to safe and accepted social standards, the more he does tend to express his aspirations and his individuality in terms of what he wears, drives, eats, his home, his car, his pattern of food serving, his hobbies.
Isn't that incredible? This is Victor Lebo, who is an industrialist. And what happened was, we all came through the terrible depression after the stock market crash in 1929. What got us out of the depression was World War II. And by the middle of the World War, the American economy was blazing white hot, pumping out guns and tanks and planes and weapons. And of course, it was clear by the mid-1940s that the Allies were going to win the war. And people began to say, well, what the heck do we do in peacetime? And the president of the United States established the Economic Council of Advisors to the President and said, how do we make that transition? And the answer came back, consumption. And Victor Lebo's statement is just the plainest statement you can get. We've got to make consumption an American way of life. Get people to buy stuff, use it up, throw it away, and buy more stuff. And once you introduce the concept of disposability, use something once and throw it away, you've got a perfect system, because you never run out of a market. But of course, all of that stuff is coming out of the biosphere, and the emissions to make this stuff goes back into the biosphere, and when you're finished with these products, you throw it back into the earth, and it's creating an enormous ecological problem. I've got a friend in Toronto who lives in the outskirts of Toronto in a high-rise apartment building, completely air-conditioned. He goes downstairs in the elevator to his air-conditioned garage, gets into his air-conditioned car, drives down the freeway into the basement of an air-conditioned commercial building, up into his office. That building is connected through a massive set of tunnels to huge shopping centers and food marts, food malls. He said, David, I don't have to go outside for days on end. So who needs nature? We've got our own habitat, and in a city, our highest priority becomes our jobs. And we need our jobs to earn money to buy the things that we want. And so the economy becomes our highest priority, and that's why we elevate the economy above ecology, and we think that everything's got to be done to service the economy, even though the economy now is so big, it is undermining the very life support systems of the planet. It's using air, water, and soil as a garbage can. Each of us now in the industrialized world carries dozens of toxic chemicals dissolved in our bodies, over a pound of plastic dissolved in our bodies. We are the consequence of this industrial growth because we've elevated the economy above the very things that keep us alive. And this is madness.
So talk to me about the problem of the economy, as we view it, at least. What is the problem there, and what do you see as a solution?
Well, the problem is that the economy comes from the same root word as ecology. Ecos is the Greek word for household or domain. Ecology is the study of home. Economics is its management. Ecologists try to determine what are the conditions and the principles that enable a species, any species, to survive and flourish. Not a bad bit of information. I would have thought any group of humans, any corporation, any government, before carrying out some new major program would say, wait a minute now, wait, before we do this, what was it that those ecologists tell us? What are those conditions and principles? Because we want to we don't want to do anything that will violate those conditions and principles. Those things are what keep us alive and healthy. But no, we elevate the economy above ecology. Our Prime Minister of Canada for 4 years has denied the reality of climate change, and he says to try to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions will destroy the economy. So he's saying the economy comes before the very principles and conditions, the atmosphere that keeps us alive. We draw borders around our property, around our cities, around our states, around our countries. And by God, we will go to war and kill and die to protect those borders. But nature couldn't give two hoots about human boundaries. It's a global issue because air doesn't stay within national boundaries, nor does water, which cartwheels around the planet. I mean, we get, in North America, we get dust blown from Africa that comes all the way to North America. When that dust reaches our borders, it doesn't say, oh, gee, I forgot my visa, I can't go to the United States. It goes where it wants, indeed, right? And then what happens then? We go to Copenhagen last year in December. 192 countries gathering to deal with something that doesn't belong to anybody, the atmosphere, through the lenses of 192 national borders and through the economic priorities of 192 countries. No wonder Copenhagen was a total failure. Because how do we deal with these issues that are transboundary, that are bigger and more important than countries or economies? We've got to put ourselves in the proper place and see that we are a part of this system called the biosphere, and that is what must be protected at all costs. We've got to shoehorn our economies, our political necessities, into the needs of nature rather than the other way around.
David, at one point in your book, to explain the relentless need for growth in economies, you compare us to bacteria in a test tube. Can you explain that for us?
We have come to believe that growth is the very definition of progress. You talk to any business person or politician and say, how well did you do last year? And within a picosecond, they will talk about growth in the GDP, in the economy, in profit, jobs, or market share. Growth has become the definition of progress. And anything in a finite world cannot grow forever. We live within the biosphere. That can't grow. It's fixed. And I use the bacteria in the test tube as the analogy for why it's suicidal to look for steady, endless growth. Anything growing exponentially has a predictable doubling time. I give you a test tube full of food for bacteria. That's an analogy with the planet. And I put one bacterial cell in, and it is us. It's going to go into exponential growth and divide every minute. So at time zero, at the beginning, there's one bacterium. 1 minute, there are two. 2 minutes, four. 3 minutes, eight. 4 minutes, 16. That's exponential growth. And at 60 minutes, the test tube is completely packed with bacteria, and there's no food left. So it's a 60-minute growth cycle. When is a test tube only half full? And the answer, of course, is at 59 minutes. They've been around 59 minutes, it's only half full. 1 minute later, completely full. So at 58 minutes, it's 25% full. 57 minutes, 12.5% full. At 55 minutes of a 60-minute cycle, it's 3% full. So if at 55 minutes, one of the bacteria looks around and says, "Hey guys, I've been thinking, we got a population problem." The other bacteria would say, "Jack, what the hell have you been drinking, man? 97% of the test tube's empty, and we've been around for 55 minutes. And they'd be 5 minutes away from filling it. So bacteria are no smarter than humans. At 59 minutes, they go, "Oh my God, Jack was right. What the hell are we going to do? We got 1 minute left." "Well, don't give any money to those economists, but why don't you give it to those scientists?" And by God, somehow those bacterial scientists, in less than a minute, they invent three test tubes full of food for bacteria. Now, that would be like us discovering three more planet Earths that we could start using immediately. So they're saved, right? They've quadrupled the amount of food in space. So what happens? Well, at 60 minutes, the first test tube's full. At 61 minutes, the second's full. And at 62 minutes, all four are full. By quadrupling the amount of food in space, you buy 2 extra minutes. And how do you add any more air, water, soil, or biodiversity to the biosphere? You can't. It's fixed. And every scientist I've talked to agrees with me. We're already past the 59th minute. Now, when I say this to business people and politicians, they get very, very angry with me. "How dare you say we're past the 59th minute? Look at our stores. They're filled with stuff. Look at our people. We're living longer. We're healthier." I say it without apology. We have created the illusion that everything is all right by using up the rightful legacy of our children and grandchildren. You don't have to believe me. Just talk to any elder that's lived in your area for the last 80 or 90 years. Just ask him, what was it like when you were a kid? Now that I'm an elder, I remember a Vancouver back in the 1930s, radically different from the Vancouver that I live in today. And I've been in the heart of the Amazon. I've been to the Serengeti, to Australia, to the Arctic. And everywhere I've gone, I've tried to find the oldest person in a village. And I say, "What was it like here when you were 5 or 6? And everywhere, the answer is chillingly similar. "It used to be so different. The air used to be filled with birds at certain times of the year. There used to be trees as far as you could see. The rivers used to be jammed with fish." All over the world, our elders are a living record of enormous changes that have happened in the span of a single human life. Now, Americans always used to say, "Well, it's the price of progress." I don't think it's progress to use up the rightful legacy of our children and our grandchildren. We'd better start asking very, very quickly, how much is enough? Are there no limits? Why do we need all this stuff? Are we happier with bigger and more stuff? What is life all about? What kind of a world are we leaving for our children and our grandchildren?
David Suzuki, this is, I think, one of the most powerful images I've heard of what some call the environmental crisis, but I think you'd probably call it the human crisis.
It's a human crisis. We're at the center of it. You know, for years, we environmentalists thought that humans are taking too much stuff out of the environment, putting too much waste back into it. And for me, I got a huge shift when I began to work with First Nations, Aboriginal people in Canada. And they showed me there is no environment out there and we are here. We are created out of the earth by the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and the energy in our bodies that comes from the sun. We are the environment. Whatever we do to the out there, we do to ourselves. So we think we dilute away our toxic emissions in the air. What the hell do you think you're doing every minute? You're breathing the air and filtering whatever is in it. We are water, and the water comes from all over the world, and we pour toxic material into the water. We pour toxic stuff into the soil. We spray it onto the food that we're going to eat. We are the environment. Whatever we do to the environment, we do directly to ourselves.
One of the most fascinating things in your work, David Suzuki, is the discussion that you have of the temperate rainforest and the salmon and its connection to it. I wonder if you could share that with us now.
That is such a wonderful story. One of the rarest ecosystems on the planet is the temperate rainforest. That's very thin strip that extends all the way from Alaska to California, pinched between the Pacific Ocean and the coastal mountain range. The salmon are born in these rivers. They go out to sea, and they grow in the oceans and accumulate the nitrogen from the ocean. And then when they come back, the bears, wolves, and eagles eat these salmon, and they poop and pee all over the woods. It turns out that the salmon are the biggest pulse of nitrogen fertilizer the forest gets. And the bears are the vectors to carry the nitrogen. They'll hunt for, or they'll fish for the salmon. Once they grab one, they hike off up to 150 meters on either side of the river and eat the salmon. They eat the best part, and they dump the rest of the carcass on the floor of the forest and go back for another one. As soon as they dump the carcass, well, salamanders and slugs and ravens begin to eat it. But the main thing are flies that lay their eggs on the carcass. And in a few days, the carcass is a seething mass of maggots eating that nitrogen from the ocean. They drop onto the forest floor, and they pupate over the winter. And in the spring, trillions of flies loaded with nitrogen from the ocean, from the salmon, hatch at the very time that the birds from South America are migrating through the forest on their way to the Arctic nesting grounds. So the salmon come back, and they nourish the flies, which feed the birds. Now, we know the forest, the salmon need the forest. If you clear-cut the forest, the salmon populations plummet or disappear, because the salmon need the forest canopy to keep the waters cool. They need the forest to hold the soil so when it rains, it doesn't run in and spoil the spawning gravels. And the forest feeds the baby salmon on their way to the ocean. So we know the salmon need the forest. Now we know the forest needs the salmon. So you see this beautiful system where the ocean is connected through the salmon to the forest, and the birds from South America are connected to the northern hemisphere. Humans come along, and we go, there are a lot of salmon here. That's the Minister of Fisheries and Oceans for the commercial fishing fleet. But, the trees, well, that's a Minister of Forestry, and the eagles, bears, and the wolves, that's a Minister of the Environment. The river, that's managed by the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Energy. And the rocks, the mountains, that's the Department of Mining. So what is a single interconnected system? We come along, fragment into different bureaucracies, and try to manage a complete system through this fractured way of looking at the world. And we will never do it in the right way when we look at it that way.
So what's the solution?
The solution is our great advantage, what got us to where we are, was our brain. We invented the idea of a future. We could dream of a future in which we could avoid danger and exploit opportunity. I believe foresight was the critical feature that got us out of the plains of Africa to occupy the entire planet. So what do we have to do? Imagine a future that is free of danger and full of opportunity. So how about this? How about an America, as Canada was when I was a kid, where you could drink the water out of any river or lake, where you could catch a fish and eat it without worrying about what chemicals are in it? An America where asthma and cancer rates plummet because we no longer use air, water, and soil to dump our toxic chemicals. Let's imagine a future full of opportunity and promise, and then We have a goal that we can work towards, and we know what direction that we want to go on, and everybody will be on it together. This is what we've done in Canada. We've created a vision for one generation away. We call this sustainability within a generation, and now we have a vision of where we would like to go. And when I presented this to the business community, to the mayors of Canadian cities, to the faith community, everybody says, well, of course, I would love to have a Canada like that. So suddenly, we're all together. We're not fighting. We all agree that's the kind of country we would like to achieve. And now we know the direction that we can move. So anything we do today, we say, okay, that's an interesting proposal, but does that get us closer or further away from that target that we're moving towards?
You say, so if Canada can make this a target, so can the United States of America.
Why not in the United States?
And what about the rest of the world?
Absolutely. I think these movements are all things that we have to begin right away.
David Suzuki's new book is called The Legacy, An Elder's Vision for Our Sustainable Future. Thank you so much, David Suzuki.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun talking to you.